Today is December the 5th, 2018. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who is using your personal data besides Facebook and Google? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of All Things Computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. At the start of the new year, 2019, the Personal Computer Show will be reformatted to be oriented to internet broadcasting. The cord cutting of the past few years have shown a shift in listeners and viewers from tuning into traditional media platforms to receiving their content on demand when it is convenient for them. We are not ending the show, just the over-air broadcast. The program will continue to be available on PRN.FM, on the internet as it is presently scheduled on Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Podcasts of the programs will continue to be available from PRN.FM or the major podcast hosting sites, as well as our website, PCRadioshow.org. In this new format, we can continue to be heard regularly every week. The on-air radio program broadcasting from WBAI-FM 99.5 New York has been subjected to so many unannounced preemptions that many listeners don't know if we're on or if we're off. Indeed, some major sites such as The Well in Silicon Valley have prematurely announced our demise earlier in the year. We will go back to our roots in which you, the listening audience, are part of the program. WBAI has not had a telephone system for our listeners to call since we moved out of the Wall Street studios in 2012 in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. If you send us your question or a brief description of what you want to discuss via email, along with your telephone number and a convenient time at which we can reach you, we will call you and record the call for broadcast during the show. If you have any questions or comments for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. Just remember, there's no such thing as a stupid question. The conversation will be recorded to be part of the show, but if you are bashful or shy or just want to remain anonymous, it's no problem. We'll just use the context of what is on your mind and attribute it to a query received in our mailbag, without identifying who wrote us the email. And if you prefer, we do have associates on the air with their feature segments. If you want them to answer your question, we can make arrangements for that too. You, the listening audience, are not the product for the Personal Computer Show, but are an integral part of the show. Just as personal computing has morphed into different supporting platforms since we first broadcast live in 1983, broadcasting on local radio stations has morphed into worldwide podcasting. We hope you will join us in this exciting new adventure and format. Send email to me, hank@pcradioshow.org, and let's talk about your computing problems, or, better yet, whatever questions or opinions you have about computing. Before we begin the regular show, we want to note that Gary Kay has passed away at age 70. Gary was an award-winning journalist who had been covering technology since IBM introduced its personal computer in 1981. He worked at NBC News, then at ABC News, Ziff Davis, CNN, and Fox Business Network. He had been in declining health for some time, and I had spoken to him recently where we had originally planned to have him do short segments for the Personal Computer Show. Gary Kay was the founder and chief content officer for Tech50Plus.com. He published this website aimed at baby boomers. He created Tech50Plus, which looks at technology through the eyes for the generation age 50 and over. We are now in the 2018 holiday season sales of special purchases. Black Friday sales started the day after Halloween this year, and Cyber Monday sales are most likely continuing through Christmas Eve. Most of the digital camera and computer systems offered for this hype sale period are discontinued models or current models being phased out for a new generation of units. I have no issues with buying any of this equipment. They are, for the most part, stable products, but they do not have the latest and greatest marketing hype features that you may not find as an absolute need to have. Canon and Nikon have introduced mirrorless cameras, and their DSLR models are being phased out. But these are still worthy of taking high-quality technical pictures. Then there is the phasing out of computer systems installed with older generations of processors. With hefty discounts, these units are still capable of useful personal computing. There is, however, a big but. I do not recommend buying any systems with an Atom CPU today. The latest Atom CPU is the Clover Trail. Early in the year, Microsoft had announced the following Intel Clover Trail processors would not be supported on Windows 10 update: the Atom Z2760, the Atom Z2520, the Atom Z2560, and the Atom Z2580. Forget about those numbers. Instead of remembering those model numbers, just avoid all Atom-based systems. Most are only 3 or 4 years old and now unable to receive new feature updates to Windows 10. But Microsoft had created an exception for those devices, allowing them to continue receiving security updates for 5 additional years. Some of these Atom PCs received a free upgrade to Windows 10 less than 2 years ago are now officially blocked from receiving future updates. Those chips first appear in entry-level Windows 8 PCs, especially in 2-in-1 devices, between 4 and 5 years ago. But if you are one of those unlucky owners of one of those first 2-in-1 PCs announced in 2012 and sold throughout 2013 and 2014, your PC was eligible for a free Windows 10 upgrade in the mid-2015 period, and it also received the summer 2016 anniversary update without any compatibility issues at all. No one really knows exactly how many Clover Trail-based devices were sold, but collectively, the total from all manufacturers was probably in the millions. It is estimated that the total number of Clover Trail devices sold was over 10 million. Today, owner of those devices who took advantage of Microsoft's free upgrade offer for Windows 10 are in for a rude awakening. Are there other PC architectures that are likely to face this issue in the next year or two? We don't know. As Microsoft moves to a Windows 10 upgrade at twice a year, with feature updates delivered in March and September and a support lifecycle of 18 months, that support policy can, in theory, cause even a 2-year-old device to end up on the unsupported list of machines for Windows 10 upgrades. The irony in this case is that Microsoft is aggressively pushing the free Windows 10 upgrade offer to owners of these devices, ramping up the pressure dramatically as the cutoff date approaches. Now, less than a year later, these devices are being cut off without notice. The bottom line: for the short term at least, this policy shouldn't affect PCs that were designed for Windows 10 or for which the manufacturer has explicitly delivered support for Windows 10 in the form of drivers and firmware updates. But that could change without notice. This may appear to the average consumer that Microsoft has planned obsolescence in product introduction that will force the user to be in a continual hardware upgrade PC mode. PCs purchased in the period of Windows XP operating system had a very long and useful life, as there was not a need to upgrade the hardware to take advantage of software upgrades. This led many computer journalists to declare the PC was dead because annual sales dropped until 2 years ago. To continue to provide software updates that are backwards compatible with older equipment, it results in higher cost and support complexity to be in sync with all different versions of hardware. It also inhibits implementation of new features such as artificial intelligence. In the early days of computing, we had business computers and we had scientific computers. What was the primary difference? Scientific computers were built with hardware floating point option, and business computers implemented floating point operation via software, which ran at significantly slower speed. Similarly, in the 1980s, leaded gasoline was phased out for unleaded gasoline to improve the environment. Eventually, I had to give up on a car that ran with no problems, but I was unable to get leaded gas, but I was able to easily change parts and install and adjust my own spark plugs in this old car. With the catalytic converter, it was not practical for most owners to have the special equipment needed to do it yourself. With all technological changes, there is an upside and there's a downside that has to be balanced for the greater good. IBM was and is today a mainframe-centric company, where all products must fit into the mainframe architecture. They even sold off their personal computing division because it was not part of their mainframe business model. I, personally, take somewhat of a more positive view on the need to buy replacement equipment even when the old is still working. Over the long term, what might you use the old equipment that is no longer supported with Windows 10 updates? They are still usable for basic office functions and internet access. Although security updates are available today, you have to plan for when it's no longer available. Consider reinstalling onto the hardware a Linux distro. There are many Linux distros whose graphical interface is very similar to Windows. Upgrade and security for these systems are available and they continue with these Linux distributions. Okay, you say to me, I'll give Linux a try, but I'm currently using Microsoft Office and I understand there are Office functions or Office packages for Linux, but OpenOffice or LibreOffice, the navigation for those systems are not the same as Microsoft Office. I use Microsoft Office at work and I don't want to have another package that I have to relearn for my use at home. I really want Microsoft Office navigation. Is anything out there? Because Microsoft Office is not available for Linux. Well, there is such a package available, and it's called WIPS, WPS, from Kingsoft. You can download it, and it's for free. The only downside for using a Linux distro today is there's no tax preparation application if you need to go beyond what is available to file online. Technological changes can be disruptive, such as the effect of Amazon with the retail industry. But if it is not disruptive, it is a creep that will fly under the radar without our awareness. To recap all this, if your computing needs are basic, older models of computing equipment at hefty discount may just be what you need, but I would avoid any Atom-based equipment that's on sale today. Sometimes you really don't need a survey or study to come up with something that is happening. Can you imagine that there's a speeding car coming at you and you have to do a survey to determine which way you should go or what action you have to take? Well, this is the case, it seems to be, where a research firm did a survey. A consumer survey by DC-based business-to-business research firm Clutch. They did a survey, found 52% reported receiving at least one robocall a day and nearly 40% reported multiple robocalls a day. That's 40%. That's a lot of people every day getting multiple robocalls. The reasons for the proliferation of annoying automated solicitation is that technology has made it cheap, and the sheer volume of consumers they reach make them effective. Heck, you don't need a survey to do that. We all knew that. Phone calls are so cheap today, it's worthwhile for the crooks to do it. When it's that easy to commit a crime, criminals will commit it. Robocalls are easy for scammers, and dropping costs means that even a robocall is only successful with one out of every 500 calls that can still make financial sense, of course, from the criminal's point of view. Marketers and scammers are getting better at getting you to pick up in the first place. One trick is using something called neighbor spoofing. Those robocallers will pretend to be calling from a local area code and will make someone feel like it could be a neighbor or a local business calling them, and they're more likely to pick up. In the Clutch survey, 21% who answered a robocall admitted to either accidentally or intentionally giving their private information. 1 in 5 actually fall for a robocall. About 1/4 of robocalls are about health topics. Well, one firm has heard your complaints, and that firm is Microsoft. Microsoft has been working with police in India to shut down fake tech support centers in the country that are scamming victims in the United States and Canada. Last week, police in the Indian capital of New Delhi raided 16 fake technical support centers, which were located with the help of Microsoft, according to the New York Times. 3 dozen people were arrested in the raids. The fake tech support center swept up the raids that made thousands of dollars by sending out pop-up ads over the internet that claimed users' computers had been infected with a virus. Victims who fell for the scheme would phone the fake Microsoft tech support center, which would then offer repair services ranging in price from $99 to $1,000. The rates come a month after Microsoft published a survey that found that more than 3 in 5 consumers have encountered a tech support scams. In addition to pop-up warnings, the fraudsters have been using phone calls, emails, and website redirects to trick users into thinking their computers are infected with a virus or spyware. According to Microsoft's survey, 1 in 5 consumers have lost money in tech support scams. That means 20% who got phone calls fell for it. The problem is so widespread that the company said it receives about 11,000 complaints about the scams each month. Microsoft also has spotted 150,000 pop-up ads related to scams every day. To fight back, the company has been dedicating resources to help authorities track down fake call centers in India, where the company says many of fake tech support scams are based. The recent raids are a good reminder to be vigilant around shady pop-ups and other scareware, which tries to frighten you into thinking your computer has been compromised. Study estimates that tech support scams have been lucrative enough to extract tens of millions of dollars in losses from consumers each year. Microsoft has a page with tips on how you can protect yourself. Do a search on the following words: Microsoft Protect Yourself from Tech Support Scams. 7 words. Do search on Microsoft Protect Yourself from Tech Support Scams, and it's very useful information that they do provide. And it's important to note that there are 2 important things that they stress. Microsoft does not send unsolicited email messages or make unsolicited phone calls to request personal or financial information or to provide technical support to fix your computer. I repeat, Microsoft does not send unsolicited email messages or make unsolicited phone calls to request personal or financial information or to provide technical support to fix your computer. The other is that any communications with Microsoft has to be initiated by you. If a notification appears with a phone number, don't call the number. Error and warning messages from Microsoft never include a phone number. And they do recommend that you download software only from official Microsoft partner websites or the Microsoft Store. Be wary of downloading software from third-party sites, as some of them might have been modified without the author's knowledge. The bundle supports scam, malware, and other threats. Apple warned iPhones have a serious problem. Reports continue to flood in that iPhone XS, iPhone XS Max, and iPhone XR are in trouble. But now, Apple faces new threat not only to its latest iPhones, but every iPhone and iPad you can buy. In short, the data on all iPhones and iPads running iOS 12 is not safe. This comes after an announcement from popular data recovery company Drive Savers that files on these devices can be accessed with a 100% success rate. Unlike most security holes which are disclosed to Apple, this one is being kept secret. Drive Savers said it is building a service around the exploit and charging users up to $3,900 if they want to access locked devices. That said, the company stresses it is using strict identification protocols from customers to ensure that they are not hacking an iPhone or iPad which doesn't belong to them. Whether or not you choose to believe Drive Savers about this, the problem is others may not be so ethical. With Drive Savers keeping the flaw a secret to protect its new service, Apple has a major job on its hand to find and fix it. Until then, the race is on for more nefarious hackers to discover and exploit it, if they haven't done it already. The Chromebooks have been quite successful in the education field, and Microsoft will now target Chromebooks with a new Windows Lite operating system. From Windows RT or Windows 10 in S mode, Microsoft has long been on a journey to make Windows lighter and more efficient, but it has little success among consumers. With Chromebooks becoming ever more popular, Microsoft is looking now to target Google's Chrome OS with a new lightweight version of Windows dubbed Lite OS. The details are naturally scarce at the present time, but it's reported that Windows Lite OS is a new version of Windows that may not actually be Windows. Hints of the new operating system were apparently found in Windows Insider beta builds and Microsoft's system development kit. Lite OS will apparently only be available for pre-installation by laptop makers and will not be targeted towards enterprises or businesses. Slightly similar to Windows 10 in S mode, the new operating system will only run progressive web apps and other apps downloaded from Microsoft Store, but with differentiating factor of having everything else stripped out. It's also meant to be super lightweight, instant on, always connected to run on any CPU, and that it might run on devices with Qualcomm's next processor. The user interface will also or may be very different from what has been seen before or could be similar to Core OS of Windows. And there's something else that is also different that we haven't seen from every attempt at launching this type of software in the past. It may not be called Windows. With a new name and a different user interface uses Windows Core operating system, it will be Windows' next big bet in the operating system field. Windows Lite would launch and is hinted that it may be released by the end of 2019. Microsoft will also need new hardware to showcase Windows Lite OS, and the timing for it may coincide with the annual developers conference late in 2019. Codename is Centaurus. Previous reports have indicated that Microsoft is planning to release a new folding surface in the fall of 2019, so that could likely be the first device for this new operating system. IBM reveals 8-bit analog chip with phase change memory. Researchers used the chip to test a simple neural net and identify numerals with 100% accuracy. At the IEEE International Electron Devices meeting in San Francisco, IBM reported a new 8-bit analog chip. The development was less about analog chips and more a radical rethinking of chip architecture. This chip is the first to perform 8-bit calculations right where the information is stored. In traditional chip architecture, data constantly shuffles between memory and processing, which consumes valuable energy and time. In-memory calculations are the logical next step for reducing power consumption while increasing performance. These gains are necessary for hardware to keep up with the advancements in artificial intelligence. IBM's new analog chip is based on phase change memory, the key ingredient to a material that can undergo phase changes in response to electrical current. In analog technology, a wave is recorded or used in its original form. So, for an example, in an analog tape recorder, a signal is taken straight from the microphone and laid onto tape. The wave from the microphone is an analog wave, and that wave on the tape can be read, amplified, and sent to a speaker to produce a sound. In digital technology, the analog wave is sampled at some interval and then turned into numbers that are stored in the digital device. On a CD, the sampling rate is 44,000 samples per second. So on a CD, there are 44,000 numbers stored per second of music. To hear the music, the numbers are turned into a voltage wave that approximates the original wave. How are analog computers different from digital computers? Analog computers process continuously varying data, whereas digital computers process data which is binary, that is to say, in the form of 0 and 1. Advantages of digital signals carry more information per second than analog signals. Digital signals maintain their quality over long distances better than analog signals. The advantage of an analog signal is the absence of distortion and noise and the wide dynamic range it has and the performance in overload conditions. Digital systems, meanwhile, have better audio recording quality and an easier integration to personal computers and software applications. IBM likens this to looking out a foggy window and seeing a blurry person walking towards your house. As soon as you recognize your mom, it doesn't matter how precise the image is, you got the right information you need without waiting for the image to come in full clarity. Feature segments for tonight: Health and Wearable Technologies by Dr. Alfred Poor, Robots in the Emergency Room. He'll also cover survey on consumer fitness wearables and which works better for employee fitness incentive programs, the carrot or the stick. From the Tech Corner, I'm going to be talking about wireless printers are vulnerable when connected to port 9100. And Marty Winston, on the home automation front, he'll be talking about cybersecurity as it relates to National Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
If you've been to a hospital emergency room in the last few years, you may have encountered a long wait before you could be seen. This is a big problem in hospitals around the country, in the U.S. and in other countries. We're now turning to automation to find ways to maybe help cut down on those wait times and make the process more efficient for both the hospital staff and the patients. There's a group in Toronto that is working on using robots to help with the initial intake and screening of patients. They're going to be using an off-the-shelf robot called Pepper, which comes from the SoftBank Robotics. This is a small humanoid mobile robot that can wheel itself around and has a display, and it can talk and listen, as well as it has cameras to look at the patient. And the interesting thing is it's going to be able to come around to patients and hopefully be able to get the intake information that they need about the patient and speed up the process and make sure that nothing gets missed and make it easier for the patient to complete the information. The other interesting thing is the system will be able to do a certain amount of triage. It will be based on the information that the patient provides. It will decide what priority that patient should be given to help the hospital staff see the patients that need help more urgently. In addition to that, it's also going to be able to determine how the patient is feeling, an emotional modeling. If they say they're feeling fine, but they're exhibiting signs of pain or stress or other discomfort, the robot should be able to recognize this and notify the emergency room staff so that they have a deeper understanding of the patient's needs than beyond just what is on the intake form. Whether or not robots like this will be able to have a positive impact on emergency room wait times and help improve the experience for the patients who come to it remains to be seen, but it's an interesting experiment and hopefully one that will help both staff and patients. Conventional wisdom has it that consumers rapidly lose interest in wearable devices such as fitness bands, and very quickly they end up stuck in the back of a drawer somewhere. Well, a new research study from a company called Valencell paints a pretty different picture. In an online consumer study, they found that 63% of the people they surveyed said that they owned a wearable device. Now, this is an update from the study they did 2 years ago when they found that only 42% of those surveyed had a wearable device. So this is almost a 50% increase in wearable device ownership. Of those who own a wearable device, nearly 3 out of 4 have used their device for a year or more. So the vast majority of people who have them are still using them. And 2/3 of the people who own these kinds of devices feel that it's had a positive impact on their health. Another interesting finding of the study is that 1 out of 5 said that they didn't trust the data that they got from their device. In fact, 93% of those surveyed reported that device accuracy was either important or very important, making it the most important factor reported. It came in ahead of comfort at 90% and ease of use at 83%. Another interesting shift is that consumers want more medical information. A majority of them want to be able to measure their blood pressure, for example, and 1/3 of them would like to be able to measure their blood sugar levels, their glucose levels. Already, we're seeing a shift towards wearable devices that have more features rather than less. Smartwatches tend to do more than your typical fitness band, and this year, 53% reported owning a smartwatch. That was up from just 32% 2 years ago. Fitness band ownership, on the other hand, is declining. Only 45% of the people in the survey reported owning one, compared to 50% just 2 years ago. So that's dropped a bit. Clearly, wearables are finding a place in our lives. People believe that they're helping them be healthier, and in fact, they are using them. One of the things we've reported about a lot at Health Tech Insider is employee incentive programs. Large employers, insurance companies, and healthcare systems are providing incentive programs for employees and insured members to exercise more in order to be healthier. This is important because these are the organizations that will see a financial benefit from healthier employees. Now, one of the questions is, what kind of incentive program works best? And the RAND Corporation recently released a very interesting report that looks at two different incentive programs that are run by a South African insurance company called Discovery. They have one incentive program that gives rewards to employees for meeting certain exercise goals. They have another one, however, where employees are given the opportunity to buy an Apple smartwatch at a steep discount and then repay that purchase price month to month over 2 years. The interesting thing is that if they hit their exercise targets, that monthly payment is lower. Now, the difference between these two is a gain-based program where you gain something, you gain rewards for meeting your goals, and the other one is a loss-framed system in which you lose something. You pay more for your watch that you're purchasing if you don't meet your targets. And the interesting thing is that loss-framed system actually produces better results. Employees exercise more, hit their targets more, and it's a more effective way of improving employee health than the gain-framed design. So it's a very interesting study and should inform other organizations who are looking to create their own employee incentive programs for exercise and improved health. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Wireless printers are vulnerable when connected to port 9100. We know what Area 51 is, but what is connecting port 9100? When you connect a printer with a printer cable to a computer, the maximum distance is 5 meters, or about 16 plus feet, when connected through a USB 2.0 port. If you are connecting through a USB 3.0 port, the maximum length of the cable cannot exceed 3 meters or just under 10 feet. This direct connect of the printer limits its use to a single user. What evolved after that was connecting more than one user to share the printer. To enable multiple users to share the same printer, print servers were added to the network to enable all network users to access the network printer. Nowadays, print server adapters are available for under $20 to make any printer into a network printer. Many modern-day printers are now available for wireless connection. Now you can print to the wireless printer from your tablet or your smartphone. The typical user network today has default settings to include the identity of their SSID to be visible. Check the port tab in the printer properties. The default setting of 9100 in the printer tab becomes a vulnerability for attackers. It is also worth mentioning that many new printers have a built-in wireless access point, unencrypted by default to allow easy printing. An attacker can connect to it while connecting to a printer through Wi-Fi. It does require the attacker to stay physically close to the device, and it may be feasible to perform the attack from outside the targeted location depending on the signal strength. It must be noted that in many educational institutions, it is common even today to assign a public IP address to all network devices, including printers. Raw printing is what we define as the process of making a connection to port 9100, a functionality which was originally introduced by HP in the early 90s, using separate hardware modules. It is a default method used by Windows printing architecture to communicate with network printers, as it is considered as the simplest, fastest, and generally the most reliable network protocol used for printers. Raw port 9100 printing is not a printing protocol by itself. Instead, all data sent is directly processed by the printing device, just like a parallel connection over TCP/IP. Such a bidirectional channel is not only perfect for debugging, but gives us direct access to results. Therefore, raw port 9100 printing, which is supported by almost any network printer, is used as a channel for security analysis. Attacking intranet printers, however, may also be attractive to an insider. Department manager's payroll. The only thing people can and should do is close these ports, because this isn't a vulnerability. It's just that these protocols don't have the options for authentication. A hacker said that he crafted a list of over 800,000 vulnerable printers, but he only targeted 50,000 in order to test if this would actually work. They said that they witnessed some errors, but that they believe around 48,000 of those printers were affected. In this case, the hacker appears not to have any malicious intent, which is the good news. They claim that motivation is to mainly warn people about the dangers of leaving their network ports open on the internet. The bad news is, the hackers also say that the attacks was easy to execute, the script they wrote is extremely short, and this entire process could have grave consequences. It can also be used to physically damage printers. At the minimum, it can cause losses in ink and paper. But port 9100 is not just limited to printers. It can also include baby monitors, and as more and more gadgets are connected to the internet, as you know, in the Internet of Things, there are far greater opportunities for bad actors to try to break into them. There's a simple and evergreen lesson in all of these incidents. Make sure your devices aren't exposed on the open internet. National Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day, also referred to as Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day or Pearl Harbor Day, is observed annually in the United States on December the 7th to remember and honor the 2,403 citizens of the United States who were killed in the Japanese surprise attack on Pearl Harbor in Hawaii on December 7, 1941. On August 23, 1994, the United States Congress designated December 7th of each year as National Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day. On November the 29th, President Bill Clinton issued a proclamation declaring December 7, 1994 as the first National Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day. On Pearl Harbor Day, the American flag should be flown at half-staff until sunset to honor those who died as a result of the attack on the United States military forces in Hawaii. Pearl Harbor Day is not a federal holiday. Government offices, schools, and businesses do not close. Some organizations may hold special events in memory of those killed or injured at Pearl Harbor.
That Sunday morning, 77 years ago, temperatures were mild with clear to partly cloudy skies over Kakuku Point on the island of Oahu, the first sighting made by the Japanese bombing run on Pearl Harbor. Rough seas had delayed the arrival of the Enterprise, a ship that later played a major role in multiple encounters. Three other aircraft carriers on the enemy's hit list were also out of port, but across Hawaii, it was a lazy and relaxed Sunday, until the bombs began dropping. We got caught by surprise. Had that not been the case, what might have been different? Certainly anti-aircraft batteries would have been ready, waiting, and active. Fighter planes might have intercepted the attackers. Warships could have left port to provide a less target-rich opportunity. The attack might not have been totally thwarted, but such countermeasures might have given the enemy pause in pursuing America as an enemy in the war. Even then, America was famous for not enduring attacks on its shores. Pearl Harbor Day remembers the victims of that attack, and arguably more so, provides a statement of America's continuing resolve not to be passive when threatened. We saw that again following 9/11. We see it again and again and again in the terror attacks and attempts on our soil. And I know from investigation that there's a greater number of threat neutralization events that are never exposed to public eyes. We're seeing a different kind of Pearl Harbor in the documented incidents of foreign intervention into American elections. Skip the party politics and the talking points. There have been enough arrests and convictions on these charges and enough incidents to take mere conjecture off the table. As significant a circumstance as election intervention and corruption present, there are greater consequences at stake in the battlegrounds where cyber warfare is planned and fought. I've done some research and had a few discussions with America's cyber warfare defenders. I think this is important to put into context. It's not yet a Pearl Harbor day for cyber attacks, but skirmishes are well underway. Let me be clear. I'm not talking about hacking, spam attacks, ransomware, or the kinds of exploits that target individuals, not even about identity theft. That's the gang, thug, and con man side of the street, the minor leagues by comparison with the more militant and often more military scope of cyber confrontations. Let me give you an idea of what enemy cyber warriors are actively trying to accomplish. I can also tell you that Russia, China, and Iran are three major epicenters of these efforts. They want to disrupt our weapon platforms. They are trying to gain entry to weapon, control, and communication systems aboard aircraft, submarines, naval warcraft, and command centers, as well as missile batteries and the nuclear weapon arming protocols, both directly and through satellites. They are trying to access and control ground-based communications. They are also targeting all manner of infrastructure services at and around key military targets. Their laundry list of things they want to disrupt include electricity, gas lines, water supplies, sewers, communication connections, security gate controls, and traffic lights. That same laundry list applies to major government administration facilities. We're talking about a lot that happens across the D.C. area. Major population centers, major financial institutions, significant material manufacturing operations, and more. They want to cripple us, disrupt us, and demoralize us to take our ability to respond off the table. For civilians, they want to destroy a way of life, not so much life itself. There is no such differentiation in their approach to military installations, nor in some key government offices. Enemy military operations are one small corner of the cyber battlefield. Official and unofficial relationships with populations of cyber miscreants become a contract-based or award-based workforce to enhance those efforts. America is not being passive, not standing still. The U.S. Cyber Command is the umbrella organization that helps coordinate efforts among the various military service-related cyber forces, like AR Cyber, the Army Cyber Command. There is also a considerable amount of cooperation with NSA, CIA, FBI, Homeland Security, and other parts of the protective landscape. America is aggressively pouring more manpower, better training, more and better equipment, and faster growth into all of these cyber defense forces. At this point, we have the faster, bigger, better guns on this battleground. But I should explain how this gets approached, and why there may be episodes where it looks like the bad guys got in a solid hit. Cyber ops has several goals that range from defensive to offensive, from tactical to strategic. It has to identify that attacks are occurring, the source of those attacks, and the nature of those attacks. They have to be able to block or neutralize those attacks. They want to be able to launch counterattacks, especially those that can eliminate the sources of attacks. And in case things escalate, they want to be fully prepared to launch our own effective assaults in kind against those enemies. America's cyber forces today are awesome. We never see them, we never hear about them, we never fully know what's going on. But we have some absolutely champion warriors in cyberspace. I probably don't need to tell you this, but every once in a while, we have to let the attackers think that they're getting away with something. It's part of the task of analyzing and counteracting their capabilities. Every military base I've ever seen seems to have a Know Your Enemy poster on the wall. This is a deeply clever way to do that. Now, ready for some bad news? There are also guerrilla wars in cyberspace, the kinds that target us one at a time, but broadly. Have you ever thought about what happens if all of a sudden those billions of stolen credit card records turn into a grand slam hit across all of them? It would put trillions of dollars into the hands of enemies, remove that money from the U.S. economy, place more than 100 million of us deeply into debt, and create an almost incurable level of disruption. The Patriot Act provides a few countermeasures. Increasing cyber defense training at the banks and financial institutions can help, and will help even more as their tools improve. But the weak point in all of this is still you, Bunky. How old are your passwords? And what have I told you about trusting the cloud? Remember, if Alexa can do it, Alexi can do it. There may be a cyber warfare Pearl Harbor day ahead. I don't believe it will be in the coming year. But I do think something big will try to take us down by the mid-2020s. If Pearl Harbor had failed, World War II might have created a very different history for the world. With more naval resources at the start, we might have been able to deploy a greater presence in both Asia and Europe. But hindsight is 2020. We only get one version of history, no rewrites. How would you like yours to be written? And how about that of your kids and grandkids? Do the little things. Install malware prevention and keep it active and current. Don't browse on shady sites. Don't take the bait on phishing messages. And be ready in case you have to reformat your entire system and restore it from a very recent backup. What if we learned from Pearl Harbor that we're all vulnerable, that we can't be complacent, and that we're not always the ones to pick the battleground? Also, when enemies are intent on attacking us, they will sometimes succeed. So far, they haven't prevailed for the long term, but in the meantime, it would diminish us not to honor our fallen. Some of you may not know that the official designation for December 7th is Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day. And there is a portion of the famous FDR infamy speech that I think is still relevant to how we regard enemies on any battleground. He said, "No matter how long it may take us, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory." Yes, America remembers and avenges our fallen. May our would-be enemies remain ever aware of that. Good night and good luck.
Thank you, Marty. And for those who have served in the armed forces or are currently in the armed forces today, we salute and thank you for your service. Public service announcements. The following are computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. All these meetings are free and open to the public. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. The Westchester PC User Group will have a presentation on holiday gifting, Thursday, December the 6th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor in White Plains, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has their general meeting December the 7th. Meeting time, 8 p.m. They meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on Do You Have Medical Questions? And Where Do You Get Reliable Answers? The meeting is held on Thursday, December the 13th, and the time of the meeting is 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 411, in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, December the 14th. They meet at 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Scherr Hall, New York Institute of Technology, located at Old Westbury Campus at Old Westbury, New York. The Brookdale Computer User Group has a presentation on what's new with Chromebooks in 2018. Meeting is Thursday, December the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they hold their meetings at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. If you have any club meetings you want me to announce on your behalf on the air, send me a note. My address is hankkey@pcradioshow.org. We like to hear from you, And if you have any computer-related questions or comments, drop us a line at hankkey@pcradioshow.org. At the start of the new year, 2019, the Personal Computer Show will be reformatted to be oriented to internet broadcasting. The cord cutting of the past few years have shown a shift in listeners and viewers from tuning into traditional media platforms to receiving their content on demand when it is convenient for them. We are not ending the show, just the over-air broadcast. The program will continue to be available on PRN.FM, on the internet as it is presently scheduled on Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Podcasts of the programs will continue to be available from PRN.FM or the major podcast hosting sites, as well as our website, PCRadioshow.org. In this new format, we can continue to be heard regularly every week. We will go back to our roots in which you, the listening audience, are part of the program. If you send us your question or a brief description of what you want to discuss via email, along with your telephone number and a convenient time at which we can reach you, we will call you and record the call for broadcast during the show. If you have any questions or comments for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. The conversation will be recorded to be part of the show, but if you are bashful or shy or just want to remain anonymous, it's no problem. We'll just use the context of what is on your mind and attribute it to a query received in our mailbag without identifying who wrote us the email. And if you prefer, we do have associates on the air with their feature segments if you want them to answer your question. We can make arrangements for that too. Just as personal computing has morphed into different supporting platforms, broadcasting on local radio stations has morphed into worldwide podcasting. We hope you will join us in this exciting new adventure and format. Send email to me, hank@pcradioshow.org, and let's talk about your computing problems, or better yet, whatever questions or opinions you have about computing. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. on PRN.FM on the internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing. And to paraphrase a noted Yuletide song, chestnuts roasting on an open fire. And so I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92, although it's been said many times in many ways, back up, and back up your system. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again. Same time, same station next week.